I've chosen a title here that's, I hope, both coherent and compatible with the general title of the event. But in particular, Chairman, I want to look at some of the lessons that we can get from cross-country comparisons. And to put that in context, let me just give you a model of science at work, which essentially is mostly carried out by the business community. About two-thirds of science as practiced in any society is carried out through business. And the process essentially is one of bringing ideas, people and money together, and out of that developing either new knowledge or new products or processes which can be carried through then and bring benefits to society. And that's a closed loop in the sense that particularly the money that motivates and carries all of that through is actually invested in the expectation of a return to the corporations that do it. So it's a straightforward and fairly obvious model. The question then is, since we're talking very largely about the public investment in the same process, is it the same thing, and can we talk about them as if, in fact, they were a coherent and compatible set of enterprises? Well, there are differences. On the business side, this combination of resources, in fact, is a closed circle which is remunerated from the benefits to society that are carried through. Public investment, on the other hand, essentially does the same thing. It brings people, money and ideas together, carries out research activities which produce not so much immediate products, services or processes that are of direct benefit to society, not for the most part. It produces all these intermediate outputs which we carefully and regularly log and perhaps give too much credibility to. That is the intermediate outputs of publications, citations and intellectual capital. But in fact, to be turned into benefits for society, that has to attract in capital in the form of new companies or new enterprises or indeed money from existing enterprises. Now, the other thing that distinguishes the public from the private is, in fact, the presence of public goods also as an objective. And I must say that in my modest position as chief scientific advisor to the government, I'm constantly asked this question: where is the payoff, direct payoff for society, rather than the payoff simply, as public representatives will see it, payoff for companies and for the private sector. So we have to distinguish that in the case of the public investment, there is this second set of benefits for society, which we call public goods, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Now, the linkages between these two are to some extent obvious, because the public investment only gets turned into benefits for society, much of it only when money, in fact, comes from the rest of society to motivate it and to carry it through into the market. There's also, of course, the fact that the public investment is largely one of creating a resource that can be used in society as a whole, and that is trained people. The process of doing research, in fact, is putting ideas to work, and the best way of translating those ideas into practice is on two feet, people moving. And of course, there are opportunities for collaboration across this spectrum. So what I want to do essentially is to do, since this is a transatlantic colloquium here, is to, first of all, let's look across the Atlantic and see what the US and the European Union can learn from each other. Well, first of all, let's benchmark them against each other. In population, the European Union is about 60% larger. It's 500 million as against 300 million. If we look at the wealth, it's only about 30% larger. In other words, the GDP per head is higher in the US, as we all know. And if we look at the R&D investment, the reverse is the case. In the United States, and this is the public R&D investment, is about 30% larger than it is in the European Union. But there's a further dimension to that we should add, and that is that the civil element of that public R&D is very different in the two places. In the European Union, nearly 90% of public investment in R&D is civil investment. In the United States, more than half is military. So there's a huge difference there. And if you look only at the civil, you can see that in Europe, there's nearly twice as much public investment going into R&D, to the science enterprise, as in the US, strictly for civil purposes. There's one further difference that I think is informative, and that is the concentration of public investment. What we see here on the left is the position in the United States, where over 90% of all public investment comes down through big pipes in Washington. It's all federal money, whereas in the European Union we're still a later experiment in an earlier course of evolution, and less than 10% of Europe's public investment in R&D comes through Brussels. So there is an enormous difference there, two huge differences, the military on the one hand and the central concentration. And I think to some extent that accounts for what is perceived and in fact is in reality, that the investment in R&D in the United States seems to produce more concentrated and more globally competitive competitive results, which you can see in many areas from GM to the health investment to the communications industry, all of which seem to be led very largely by investment from across the Atlantic. So I think those lessons have some, those comparisons have some lessons for us, and perhaps if we have time later on, Chairman, they can be debated. Now, let me shift back to Europe and look at differences in Europe and see what they can tell us. And the starting point for this really is the Lisbon Agenda of the year 2000, more than 10 years ago. And this is the basic statement of purpose. It was that, and I've highlighted here, the intention was that the European Union should be competitive, dynamic, knowledge-based economy, which we all know. But the objectives are stated also. The first objective, economic growth. Secondly, employment. And thirdly, social cohesion. So there's a complex there, but the important point to make is that it starts with an economic one. So the economic objective is the first one. So let's just look at the objective was to be achieved then within 10 years by having an average of 3% of GDP spent on R&D, and as we'll see later on, that has not been achieved in that time period, and that the balance should be about one-third public and about two-thirds business, which effectively it is. So if we look at the wealth across the European Union, we have 27 countries, and they vary surprisingly largely in wealth, from about $5,000 per head in the poorest countries, some of the ex-communist countries, to close to 10 times that, $50,000 per head in the richest countries in the European Union. And there's a sort of migration, a sort of gradation from south and east being poorer to north and west being richer. Now, these are statistics that are available to everybody, and we know that there is a spectrum of economic wealth in countries, and the declared objective of public investment in R&D is to increase that. So the question that can reasonably be asked is GDP enough? And when President Sarkozy took office, you may remember that one of the first things he did was to set up a commission to look at precisely this question. You know, is economic growth the objective of society, and is it a sufficient carrier wave to bring all the other things that society requires? So I did a small experiment by taking some of the other indices of development in society and compared them with GDP. So what I've done here is simply superimposed on that GDP spectrum a thing called the Human Development Index, which is the first measure that's used internationally, and that's a compendium of GDP, of wealth, of health measured by life expectancy, and of educational levels in society. So there's more than GDP, there's health and education. And you can see that they say essentially the same thing, correlation 0.9 across that spectrum. So to that extent, if you're happy to say human development is measured by those three indices, you could say GDP is a fairly good predictor of it. Another one is a thing called the Satisfaction with Life Index, which is more direct. They send inquiries out and they actually ask people, are you more or less, are you happy with your life? And again, if you take the best set of these data and compare it with GDP, correlation 0.85, not quite as good a predictor as the Human Development Index, but still quite good. So on both of those, you could say that GDP is a reasonable objective for public investment in R&D. Well, if we take it a stage further, there's a thing called the Happy Planet Index, which some of you may know from the country of Bhutan, where it is heavily weighted by the environmental footprint of society on the world we live in, how balanced people live with their environment. And here, of course, we get quite a different picture. Correlation 0.35 in this case, very little relationship between the footprint that we make in the world and the wealth in society. And the final one then is a measure of equality, the Gini index, which most of you would know. And here the relationship is even poorer. I mean, rich does not mean equal. So the conclusion of this essentially is that public investment directed at economic development doesn't deliver everything society needs. But my conclusion, and it's something for debate, Chairman, if we have time, my conclusion is that it's a reasonable starting point. Because you can't just by investment in R&D deliver all of the benefits that society requires, but the growth in economic well-being is the enabler of these others. And these others are delivered in society not by investment in science, but by investment in society itself, in our political and social structures. So let me move on, Chairman, to just a few quick snapshots then of what's happening in the European Union. The total investment, public and private, is something between 2.5 and 300 billion euro. And this map simply shows how it's distributed across the countries. And it's as is fairly evident, and as you might expect, the large countries have the largest proportion of the total. Germany, France, and the UK, the three biggest. So these are more or less proportional to the scale of countries. But scale isn't everything. If you look at it as percent, the expenditure on R&D, and this is total expenditure, public and private, as percent of GDP. Only two countries out of the 27 have in fact achieved the 3% target, which was set 10 years ago, and which is still there as a legitimate target for the future. And again, you can see that the other central European countries have about 2% of GDP, and the peripheral ones then somewhere in or about 1%, and perhaps a little more than that. And the final picture, of course, is that the university, the distribution of universities as ranked by these rankings that have been talked about yesterday, with all their deficiencies, do show a concentration again, not just in the larger countries, but particularly those that speak English, who have an advantage in these rankings. So, essentially, then, my conclusion is that there's something to be learned by looking across the Atlantic and comparing our structures and asking why they're different and is one better than the other. And in particular, this much later experiment. I mean, after all, the United States is an experiment that's been going for two centuries. The European Union is an experiment that's been going just for a generation and is still very much under construction. So are there lessons to be learned from these? The final slide is the commercial. Come to Dublin in July next year because it will be the best, biggest general science event in Europe and perhaps in the world. Thank you very much.